Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today's episode is brought to you by the beverage, a big cold bottle of water from the refrigerator. Ice cold. It's so hot today. Oh my god. Melbourne weather, I tell you what. The world just went from like, yeah, hey, come on out, everybody. It's a normal world outside. Yesterday. And then today it's like, rah, I'm the world. I'm here to kill you. And it's like a billion degrees. Might be a bit of extra background noise tonight. It's because I've just opened up the window and the blinds in my office to let some of the nice evening air in. But that also lets in quite a lot of the not-so-nice traffic noise. So you might hear a bit of cars and stuff in the background. Don't be alarmed. I'm not on the road. I am in my house. It's just very noisy. Today we're talking about part 3, chapter... 31. And then we're reading chapter 32. And that's the end of part 3. I'm just seeing that now. So we're going to finish part 3 tonight. That's pretty excitement. The discussion prompts I left for you guys. Will Levin's brother make it to spring? And how will this confrontation with mortality affect Levin? Kind of came a bit out of nowhere, didn't it? Just suddenly, like, his brother's there and, oh, yep, brother's dying. Brother's here and is looking very sick. It wasn't a very happy chapter. And at the same time, he didn't want to see his brother. Sorry. I'm just trying to cool myself down by drinking some of this cold water. It's so hot. I don't want it anymore. You know, all through winter, I'm thinking, oh, bring on the hot weather. I can't wait for summer. And now we get one stinking hot day, and I'm already like, nope, I'm good. No more of that. None of that, please. I Am Norwegian says, what a... Oh, yeah, hey, by the way, I'm doing a lot of complaining. Because I am very, very, very hot. But, good news, I became an uncle again today for the second time. My brother and his wife welcomed into the world their second child. The second little girl. I've been getting little pictures. I haven't been able to go in and see them yet. I'll probably do that tomorrow. But I've been getting photos all day from them and from my mum. Cute little baby photos. So that's the good news today. It is a glorious day. Even if I am complaining about it being too hot. I Am Norwegian said, what a quick turn to a somber and morbid mood. It was a quick turn to a somber and morbid mood in the book. As I say that, I realize what a roller coaster this podcast has been so far. We talk about the somberness of the chapter, then how hot it is, and then happy news about a baby, and then back into the somber chapter. It's all over the shop. If you're just trying to find, like, feel one emotion at the moment, you've chosen the wrong podcast because I'm taking you back and forth. It was a somber and morbid chapter. Levin's brother talking about his plans and his future when he doesn't have one has got to be the most depressing thing in the book this far. I don't really know what to say about Levin discovering death. The Stoics argued that you should keep death beside you at all times so you realize the value of your time and so that you don't shrink away from your life and plans because of fears that are trivial in comparison. Death really changes your perspective, especially if you've been so wrapped up in yourself as Levin has. Levin is stumbling into existentialist territory where he will be forced to justify his plans in light of death and how everything he builds will be erased with time. Maybe this will be the kick in the butt he needs to approach Kitty. Maybe it will be. Maybe a little bit of a morbid, existential crisis is what he needs. to kick his butt into gear and go and approach the woman of his dreams. I just had like a wave of loudness from outside. I don't know if you heard that, just some cars going past noisily. And thought, oh, I really should close that window. But then at the same time, a little gust of cool air hit me right in the neck. And I thought, oh, definitely gotta leave that window open. That window. It's the bringer of noise and cool breezes. Sorry. It's too hot for me to think clearly. Am I making sense? I don't know. I think the first really hot day of the year is always a struggle. Like, your body's just like, what is this? I'm not used to this. All right, Thermos of Beer said, I had read that this feeling Levin gets here happened to Tolstoy himself. Although I don't know how reliable the source is. Well, there you go. Maybe Tolstoy had a little existential crisis of his own. And there's a quote. In 1869, however, Tolstoy's life started to change. During a trip to a distant Russian province, he underwent an agonizing experience of human mortality. In the middle of the night, he was seized by a sense of futility of all endeavors, given that death could be the ultimate, only ultimate outcome. It was not death itself that horrified him, but the fact that life seemed to have no meaning if death was guaranteed to follow. This experience haunted him ever more forcefully over the next 10 years. As he explains in A Confession, he increasingly restlessly sought the meaning of life in the great thinkers of science, religion, and philosophy, all in vain. Nowhere could he find anything that gave meaning and value to life. He even contemplated suicide. Oh, the old agonizing experience of human mortality, seized by a sense of futility of the endeavors, of all endeavors in the middle of the night. Isn't that what just they call going to bed at the end of the night? That's what I do literally every night. I lie in bed and go, ah, was that another day? Was that another one of the things that we, you know, do in a row every day, days in a row? Then that's it. That's life. Tick another one off the calendar. Do another one tomorrow. Doing days. It's just a bunch of days in a row. Swim said the mama fish. He says your comment led me to explore existentialism and death. Oh no, I'm so sorry, Swim said the mama fishy. Not that it was my comment, but sorry that you've just had an existential crisis. I wasn't understanding it. Your comment found this great article. It contained this tidbit that seems relevant to your comment and this chapter. Death, existentialists argue, brings life and its possibilities into focus. In the process, it reveals what we are ultimately capable of being. Heidegger argues that confronting death brings to light the totality of our potentiality for being in a moment of vision. We grasp our full sphere of potential, a realm of potential that is ours and ours alone, and we may or may not take advantage of. We catch a glimpse of our whole person, our total capacity to exist, and we experience obligation to live up to our capacity before death takes it away. Yeah, all that. I've had all that. You know, on a day where, today though, where it's overwhelmingly hot, none of that happens. You know, you just think, ugh, like that's all you're capable of thinking. And that whole theory about, that whole thought process of like, oh, what's my potential as a person and am I living up to it? And you only get one life and it could be this or that, or it could be everything or it could be nothing. All that train of thought just seems like an indulgent luxury. It was like, oh man, I wish it was at appropriate temperature right now to entertain those kinds of thoughts, but not in this heat. Mm-mm. Existential crisis. You can wait for the weather to cool down a little bit. At least let me have a cool shower first or something like that. Bring my core body temp down. Oh man, I am babbling. I'm sorry about tonight's podcast, everyone. Let's read the chapter. Let's read the last chapter in book three. Part three, I should say. Not book three, part three. chapter 32 goes like this. Levin had long ago noticed that after people have made one uncomfortable by their pliancy and its submissiveness, they soon become unbearably exacting and aggressive. He felt that this would happen with his brother. And really, Nicholas's meekness did not last long. The very next morning, he grew irritable and cavilled at everything his brother said, touching his most sensitive spots. Levin felt guilty but could do nothing. He felt that if they both spoke without dissimulation and straight from the heart, they would only look into one another's eyes, and Constantine would say nothing but, "You will die, you will die," and Nicholas would only say in reply, "I know I shall die, and I am afraid, afraid, afraid." That was all they would say if only they spoke straight from the heart, but that would make life impossible. Therefore, Constantine tried to do what all his life he had tried and never known how to do, although he had often observed that many people were able to do it well, something without which life was impossible. He tried to say something different from what he thought, and he felt all the time that it sounded false and that his brother detected him, and grew irritable. On the third day of his stay, Nicholas challenged his brother to explain his plans to him once more, and not only found fault with them, but purposely confused them with communism. "You have only taken an idea from others and distorted it, and you wish to apply it where it is inapplicable. But I tell you that the two things have nothing in common. Communists deny the justice of property, capital, or inheritance, while I do not deny that main stimulus." It was repulsive to Levin to find himself using such words, but since he had been engrossed in his work, he had involuntarily begun using more and more foreign words, "but want only to regulate labor." "That is it. You have taken other people's idea, dropped all that gave it force, and wish to make one believe that it is something new," said Nicholas, angrily jerking his neck. "But my idea has nothing in common." "That idea," said Nicholas Levin with a sarcastic smile and angrily glistening eyes, "that idea, at any rate, if one may say so, has a geometric charm of definiteness and certainty. It may be utopian, but granting the possibility of making a tabula rasa of the past and abolishing private property and families, then labor comes by its own. But you have nothing. Why do you muddle it? I never was a communist, but I have been, and now I think it is premature but reasonable, and that it has a future as Christianity had in the first centuries. I only think that the force of labor must be dealt with in a scientifically experimental manner. It must be studied and its characteristics. But that is quite unnecessary. That force finds its own form of activity in accord with its degree of development. There used to be slaves everywhere, then villeins, and we have labor paid in kind, and leaseholders and hired labor. So what are you looking for?" At these words, Levin suddenly grew warm, for at the bottom of his heart he felt that it was true that he wished to balance between communism and the existing forms of life, and that this was hardly possible. "I am seeking for a way of making labor profitable for me and for the laborers," he answered hotly. "You do not want to establish anything. You simply want to be original, as you have always done, and to show that you are not just exploiting the peasants, but have ideas." "You think so? Well, then leave me alone," said Levin, and he felt that a muscle was uncontrollably quivering in his left cheek. "You have no convictions, you never had any. You only want to flatter your self-esteem. Well, all right, but leave me alone." "I will, and high time too. You can go to the devil, and I am sorry I came." However much Levin tried afterwards to pacify his brother, Nicholas would not listen to it, but said that it was much better for them to part, and Levin saw that life had become simply intolerable for his brother. Nicholas had quite made up his mind to go. Constantine came to him again and in an unnatural manner asked his forgiveness if he had offended him in any way. "Ah, this is magnanimity," said Nicholas and smiled. "If you wish to be in the right, I can let you have that pleasure. You are in the right, but all the same, I shall go away." Only just before he left, Nicholas kissed Constantine and suddenly said with a strange and serious look at his brother, "Do not think too badly of me, Kostya," and his voice trembled. These were the only sincere words that had passed between them. Levin understood that they were meant to say, "You see that I am in a bad way, and perhaps we shall not meet again." He understood this, and tears trembled in his eyes. He again kissed his brother, but he did not know what to answer. 3 days after his brother's departure, Levin left for abroad. He surprised young Shabatsky, Kitty's cousin, whom he happened to meet at a railway station, by his moroseness. "What is the matter with you?" asked Shabatsky. "Nothing much, but there is little to be happy about in this world." "Little? You'd better come to Paris with me instead of going to some Mulhausen or other. You'll see how jolly it is, how jolly it will be." "No, I have done with that. It is time for me to die." "That is a fine thing," said Shabatsky, laughing. "I am only preparing to begin to live." "Yes, I thought so too, till lately, but now I know that I shall soon die." Levin was saying what of late he had really been thinking. He saw death and the approach of death in everything, but the work he had begun interested him all the more. After all, he had to live his life somehow, till death came. Everything for him was wrapped in darkness, but just because of the darkness, feeling his work to be the only thread to guide him through that darkness, he seized upon it and clung to it with all his might. End of part 3. Well, there we go. Big discussion thread, hopefully, for this one, because let's talk about that chapter and let's also talk about the whole of part 3. I hope to see you over in the subreddit for a good old-fashioned chat. I could have just waited like 10 more seconds and taken that drink of water after the podcast, but it was looking at me funny. That bottle of water was just like eyeing me off, and I had to give it a sip. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.